See a note here. We keep our smoking to a minimum. We've arrived at the moment for which we've all been waiting, and I know that it's taking nothing away from Elsa or Joe or Ed, Tommy, or any others who have appeared on this program to say that this is it. And how do you go about introducing a man like Chuck to AA's anywhere? It would be like introducing St. Peter to the other apostles. And of all people, someone like myself, I undertake to tell you something about Chuck. He and his lovely wife, Elsa, have been carrying this message, this wonderful message of AA, over the country for a good long while. And they are speakers of the first quality. But more than that, they've been carrying the message on a personal basis. As recently I was with a man in Chicago, from Chicago, down at Augusta. Some of you heard him, Jim. And I told Jim that I expected to see Chuck this weekend. He asked me to convey Chuck his love and kind regards. He met Chuck early out on the West Coast and is now restored to the position from which his daddy kicked him out some years back. He's the president of a large corporation. In other words, Chuck is an AA in the finest tradition. And with that, what more is there to be said? Except that I give you Chuck.
Mighty careless of that cigar. I'm old Watts's name. Frustrated actor from Laguna Beach, California, and I'm an alcoholic. I don't know why it's always my turn to bat after the game's over. If you look closely, you'll note that I haven't got my dog tag on. I've sort of been hoping that burly bouncer Clarence would keep me out of this meeting this morning. Been a very wonderful weekend up until now. I've enjoyed it so much. I've had more meetings than there have been meals. And I'm talking about some of these people that have been eating all the time, you know. The Those Canadians are going back about 5 pounds heavier than they were when they came down. They don't like grits. Bet they ate them. I'm not going to mention any names, but every meal but this morning, they ate mine. They thought the sausage was a little bit too highly seasoned, you know. So I ate mine. I didn't. It's a beautiful morning. This morning the sun came out and they turned the heat on. You know, it tickles me when people talk about what a great guy I am. It tickles me. You know, I've made something like 5,000 talks in this society of ours. I've never said an original thing yet. I've stolen everything I've had to say. And when you're quoting me, you're quoting yourself, and you don't know it. I was talking to some guy yesterday, and I said to him, why is it if I'm so damn good that every time I go into prison in the country, and I've been in prisons all over this country, in Canada, and the Hawaiian Islands, and every time I go into one, I see from one to half a dozen people that have heard me on the outside. If I'm so hot, what are they doing in there? Oh, me. One of the things I think we ought to recognize, all of us, and I suspect we all do, is that there are no big and no little in this fellowship. There are none large and there are none small. You see one guy listen to me and get drunk, and listen to you and get sober. Strange as it might seem, that's the way it is. Some guy was introducing me some years back, and he said right at the podium, introducing me, he says, I've heard this man talk 3 times, and 3 times I've gone right out and gotten drunk, and he was introducing me. And I said to him, I think it'd be wise if tonight you'd go out and sit in my car and turn the radio on. And when I get through, we'll call you back in here and let you close this meeting, and maybe you won't have to get drunk. You see, every one of us have our place in you. Every one of us. This is a unique thing, and we are unique people. See, God never created two of us just alike. He don't make mistakes. If he'd have made two of us just alike, one of us would have been unnecessary. And each of us have our own contribution. And nobody can make your contribution but you. And nobody can make my contribution but me. It's a very unique thing. And there are those who nobody but you can touch, can reach. Because of your unique experience, and the uniqueness of you and your similarity to them. There are those whom nobody but you can touch. And you see, that's the reason that we must be ready, able, and willing to make our own contribution. Because nobody can make it but you, and nobody can make mine but me. One of the greatest guys that I know in Alcoholics Anonymous, I've never heard make a talk. I don't know if he ever did. He's an ex-bartender. He was at the first meeting I ever attended, almost 21 years ago. He's been sober ever since. He makes coffee for all the groups in the Bay Area. And every time I go down there, I run to the kitchen if I get there in time. And I have a meeting with old Stanley over the coffee pot. And if I don't get there in time, I wait until everybody goes, and then I stand with him over the broom. And we have a meeting. And I'm only one. Hundreds of people have meetings with Stanley all the time. But he never gets up here and talks. You know? But he is a most wonderful AA and a carrier of the message. The people to whom my hat is off are those who are serving on the panel at the jail, you know, getting the speakers to go down to jail every week of the world. You never heard of them. You never will hear them. But they're there every day, every week. They've got their little meeting lined up. And in those institutions, A was, is, and will be one drunk talking to another. One drunk sharing his spirit, experience, strength, and hope with another in the dark room. And we must never forget it. These occasions are terrific. They're wonderful. And I wouldn't at all think of not having them. But this is sort of the frosting on the cake. The job's done in the dark room. One alcoholic talking to another. The language of the heart. Sometimes we sort of forget this. Sometimes, particularly, and I can say this because most of us here have had a few years in this great fellowship. I haven't run onto anybody yet that was here for the first meeting. This was the first weekend. There might be somebody here, but I haven't run into them yet. So we're all sort of old-timers. It's so easy sometimes to forget what a joy it was when we first got here. Because we get here in a state of temporary surrender. And people who know us, but whom we don't know, because they're alcoholics too, share their experience, strength, and hope with us. And we get sober. And it seems so easy. It seems like we don't hardly do nothing, you know. But we're sober. And it's a new thing. And we have new friends and new people. And it's good. And they give us a little something to do. They get us busy on the ashtrays and the coffee. And this is good. And we're happy as bird dogs. And we discover that we're sober. And we got to talk about it. We got to talk about it. So we start working with drunks. And things get good in their lives. And there's great joy within us. And we get a year old, 2 years old. And sobriety sort of becomes the norm with us. That is physical sobriety. And other things begin to get important. And the first thing you know, we forgot. We forgot about those early days. And the light sort of goes out of our eyes. And we get concerned about other matters. Things become important to us. And get between us and our program and our God. And if we're not careful, we get drunk. If we're lucky, we don't. And we hear each other talking about getting off the pink cloud. There is nothing in my book that says that pink cloud is supposed to turn gray. There is nothing in my book that says the honeymoon is just of short duration. Everything I read in my book and everything that's happened in my life would indicate to me that the pink cloud gets pinker and the honeymoon becomes sweeter as the days turn into months and the months turn into years. And if this hasn't happened in our lives, we're missing the boat. We're missing the boat. What is sobriety? What is sobriety? Certainly, sobriety is not just that I haven't been nipping on that flit this morning. You know? Just because I haven't been drinking out of the bottle, am I sober? I don't think so. I don't think so. I was a periodic for 10 years. The last 10 years of a 25-year drinking career. And I was sober physically as I am today between every two drunks for 10 years. Just as sober physically as I am right now. Between every two drunks for 10 years. And yet I got drunk again and again and again and again and again and again. So I don't think I was very sober. It's no chore, it's no big thing to get sober. Even habitual drunks have to get sober once in a while. They get wandering around, the gin arms get them or something, and they have to get sober, physically. And a periodic has to get sober often. Because, you see, we periodics are hogs. We got to drink it all. You can't drink like a periodic and not have to get sober. Because the time comes when you can't get it down and you can't get it up and you can't live and you can't die. And you have to sober up. There's nothing in my book that talks about physical sobriety. There's nothing in there that talks about sitting with a drunk in the dark room, feeding him a little Caro syrup and water and holding his hand. That isn't in there. We do it. As individuals, we do lots of this. But that isn't what our book's talking about. Our book's talking about not having to sober up anymore. About sobriety, about not having to drink again. Not having to take that next drink. That's what our book is all about. That's what our program's all about. That we might find a state of being that makes a drink or a pill or a needle absolutely unnecessary. That's what our book talks about. So what is sobriety? Sobriety is the ability to live with oneself, P peacefully, joyously, and comfortably. To live with oneself in peace and joy and comfort. We formerly drank to get comfortable. And there was a time when we could get comfortable with the bottle, you know? Now we so live that we are comfortable and we don't have to drink. And this is the great miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. We don't drink because it's not necessary to drink. We don't have to drink. We have the thing that we were looking for in the bottle. You know, I had a great and frustrating life between the age of 13 and 43 because I was trying to make this old world over so it would be a fit place for me to live in. You stupid asses didn't live like I knew you should. And like I told you how. And so I tried to fix that. I was making you over, trying to. But I got news for you. The world ain't ready. It ain't ready. And so finally I ran out of my own resources. Came here for something else. Just to find a way to live that didn't include liquor. And I found a way to live comfortably, peacefully, and joyously with me. And ever since that happened, I haven't had a bit of trouble living with you stupid people. Haven't had a bit of trouble. I don't have to make you over. Don't have to change you at all. Because it isn't necessary. I'm comfortable with myself. And what a wonderful thing it is. There are two of the greatest lines in our book. Two of them, to me, are these. We cease to fight anything or anybody. We cease to fight anything or anybody. Now, what a thing this is. To be able to live without the necessity to prove anything. To be able to live without the necessity to win anything. Or to change anybody. We cease to fight anything or anybody. Life becomes easy when this is unnecessary. The next one is, here are the steps we took. You know, we're peculiar breed of cats, we Aggies. I don't think anybody ever said that we were dull or stupid. I don't think anybody ever classified us as dull, stupid people. We're sort of smart. We tell each other about our keen alcoholic minds, you know. You don't hear much about that in the marketplace. But in meetings, we tell each other, you know, and we sort of like it. Keen alcoholic mind. Terrific, isn't it? Why can't we read that line? Here are the steps we took. There's nothing, there are no big words there. There isn't a big word in it. Here are the steps we took. What's wrong with that? Why can't you and I read it? But we can't. We can't. Why can't we read the first step in our program? We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. We can't read that. With these keen alcoholic minds. We read the first step. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable whilst drunk. Many of us read it that way for years. Whilst drunk, maintaining the illusion that we're pretty cute operators when we're sober. You know? The book don't say that our lives had become unmanageable whilst drunk. An alcoholic's life is unmanageable whilst drunk. It's not talking about why we're drunk. It's talking about an unmanageable life while we're sober. But we can't read that, you know, whilst drunk. If we had a discussion meeting this morning, and we're talking about the second step, we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. The first guy that got up would talk about the insane things he did while he was drunk, you know? And the second guy would beat him. It's like Tommy said, he got him prenatal last night, you know. Prenatal drunk. Sanity whilst drunk. Insane. We can admit we did insane things whilst drunk. But we still maintain to ourselves, subconsciously, that we got a keen alcoholic mind while sober. Show you how keen my mind is. I was between 40 and 43 in the worst part of my drinking. That was the last 10 years of hell. And I would sit there or lie there in my bed after I'd been there quite a while. And I would wake up right early in the morning. I didn't wake up, I came to. And maybe I would discover that the bottle was dry. I'd drunk it all during the night. Or that Mrs. C. had ascertained where it was. And had changed its position, or that I'd hidden it from myself. Now, this is the most frustrating thing on the face of the earth. There is nothing that can compare with knowing you got a bottle in the house and knowing that you hid it someplace and you can't find it. It's not half as bad if somebody got it on you. But when you hid it from yourself, this is the most frustrating thing in the world. So I'd be lying back there in that bed, nothing to drink, dying. And a couple of blue jays would light in a tree there, right out of my bedroom window. Now, this was a sort of a tropical fruit tree. It had lots of fruit on it. It was sort of an inverted bunch of grapes. Little larger fruit than grapes, but they like a grape, bunch of grapes upside down. And they had sort of big seeds in them, and birds ate them when they were ripe. And they left seeds, and blue jays eat seeds. And these two blue jays would fly in there and start squawking at each other. And they told me, big boy, there's a new day being dawned, and you ain't going to be with it. You know? You ain't going to be with it. And I developed a resentment against those birds. Because they had no right to tell me what a bum I was. And as time went on, I developed quite a hatred towards those birds. All because they were telling me, you know, new day, and you ain't going to be with it. And so I started to dreaming up ways and means of capturing them. Now, I could have killed him. You know, I could have shot him. But that was too good for him. I was going to capture him. And when I got him, I was going to pull the feathers out of him one at a time. And when I got him stripped naked, I was going to stick him back one at a time. Now, mind you, I was between ages 40 and 43. Now, isn't that a keen alcoholic mind? I would say that I just missed being a quiz kid, but I ignore. And because I hadn't done the little things in life for many years, I had to do something big. You know, the longer we drink, the more important it is to do that big thing. We haven't got time to do the little things. We got to do something big to get us back in the stream of life. And in my alcoholic stupor, I would dream of saving the Pope in an earthquake. Now, you don't know how far out that is. I'm not even a Catholic. And I was drunk in Beverly Hills, and I think he's in Rome or someplace like that. But this was a recurring dream over and over again. I was going to save the Pope in an earthquake. Keen alcoholic mind, isn't it? It's a good thing for the likes of me that there is a power greater than ourselves that is available to us when we fulfill the conditions. Else I would have been dead 20 years ago. If anybody ever needed a power greater than himself, I did. Because, you see, I don't learn too easy. I don't learn too easy. It's almost impossible to conceive of a guy being physically sober and being otherwise a rather productive individual. I never had any trouble making a living when I was sober. I made my living since I was 13 years old. I was born working. You know? I never had any trouble when I was sober. And to think of a guy that was an A student and an athlete could do anything. To think of a guy like that, physically sober, with a 25-year record to look at, the last portion of which, the last 10 years of which, was hell on wheels. To be able to look at that cold, sober, physically, the record, and come up with the profound conclusion, this time it's going to be different. This time it's going to be different. It seemed like it's impossible. You know? How could we look at a thing like that year after year? It was different. It was worse. It was just like it always had been, worse every time. But that isn't the difference we thought it was going to be. We had decided we had it licked. We were going to be all right. And I gave this thing everything I had. I gave it everything I had. Because, you see, I could not surrender. I couldn't. The word surrender was not in my vocabulary. I had one fight that lasted 20 years. My oldest brother and I started fighting the day I was born, and we fought until I was 20 when I left home. He was 3 years and a half older than I, 3 years and a half stronger, and he could always whip me. But he never could make me believe it. I left home at 20 knowing that I could whip the guy. You know? And he'd whip me for 20 years straight. Well, if I had agreed with my adversary quickly there about 10 years before, I could have saved a lot of eyes and old clothes. Because he walloped the bejesus out of me. But he could never make me believe it. Same thing with this flick. I put everything I had in that fight. All my wit and wisdom, I put in. My wife, I put in. Our children, our home. My job, my health, my sanity, and my money, I put in the fight. And I lost. I lost. And I had to do it that way. I had to do it that way because I had to win. If there had been any possibility of me living in left field, I would still be out there. But I ran out of everything. I was fresh out of people as well as everything else. And finally, out of choice. I had no choice. And I had no place else to go, so I came here. But not until after I'd used up every resource I had. And so again, it's a good thing for me and people like me that there is a power available to you and to me when we fulfill the conditions that allows it to happen. Now, it's real interesting, this little dealy. This power greater than we are. And inasmuch as this really is a sort of a retreat, they'd change the name, you know. They used to call it an AA retreat because these guys down here got this thing started. Didn't know that there wasn't any such thing as an AA retreat. You know? So they got told and they changed it to the AA Roundup, the Mont Eagle Roundup. I wouldn't have done it that way if it had been me, because I haven't told them. So I'll take this opportunity. I would have changed it to a retreat for AAs. There's nothing the matter with a retreat for AAs, but there's no such thing as an AA retreat because this really is a retreat. This ain't no conference. We are supposed to be on this hill at this particular time to share with each other our living experience of our struggle and our successes and our failures in establishing a personally acceptable relationship with the living God that made us. That's what this particular deal is about. To charge our spiritual batteries, if you will. And so we're going to think a little about it. Thoughts and the thoughts I've gleaned from people like you about this particular subject. I was talking in Pasadena a little while back. I don't know when it was. It was on Halloween night. I wish I hadn't mentioned that, because I got to tell a story, and it's a bad word in it. We got an old boy in Pasadena. He's a good Roman boy. He's got a name. Pretty near busted his anonymity right here. Old Tom C. And he'd had a heart attack. He's been around 18 years. He's a great guy. Nice shock of white hair, and he's quiet. And he'd had a heart attack, and he was back to his first meeting for maybe 60 days. And he was giving out the birthday cakes. We do that in the West Coast. Every time a guy has a year, we give him a cake and have a candle, and we sing happy birthday. Some people think it's lousy, I think. But we think it's fabulous. We think it's fabulous. Not for us, but what a deal it is for a youngster sitting back there in the back to see somebody getting a birthday with 18 candles on. You know? When he can't think of staying sober 18 days, somebody gets up there and bawls over a silly little old cake with 18 candles on and a bunch of would-be tenors singing happy birthday to you. You know? So Tom was giving out the cakes. And it was Halloween. And in between cakes, he was telling about this little dealy. He said these two older folks were sitting at home giving out tricks or treats, you know. And it was getting late, and they'd pretty well given away all they had. There's little candy left to play, too. So the man says to his wife, he says, honey, it's getting late. He says, I don't think there'll be any more kids around. He says, let's go to bed. She says, I think you're right. And they got up and started to get ready to go to bed. And the doorbell rang. They went to the door, and here's a little old knot-headed boy and his and his sister, you know. And they both had their bags standing there, open bags in their hand. And so the old man looks over, and he sees a little more candy on the plate, so he brings it over and puts it in the little girl's bag. And there was a little old boy, you know. And he looks around for something to put in there, and there's a plate with a few apples on. And he got that and dropped the apples in the little boy's bag. And the little chap, he says, son, I bet you broke my potato chips. Now, you see, I wouldn't have heard that if I hadn't been in an AA meeting. But anyway, after the meeting was over, there's an old boy there. He was a doctor, medical doctor. And he told me this little story. He said, my father was a Methodist bishop. And he had a very good friend who was a Monsignor in the Catholic Church. And they were very great friends, these two. And they used to get together and discuss religious matters, a great deal, philosophy and religion. And he said he was a little old boy, 7 years old. And he, at one of these discussions, said to the Monsignor, he says, you're always talking about prayer. You're talking about prayer all the time. He says, what does God do when you pray? He says, does he talk back to you? Does he say anything? What happens? And His father said to the Monsignor, the boy asked you an honest question. Now you give him an honest answer. And the Monsignor thought about it a little bit. And he says, son, he says you pray, and then you do it yourself. You pray, and then you do it yourself. Now, I think that's fabulous. Maybe you don't like it. Like Red Skelton, I think the wrong bus came in tonight. You pray, and then you do it yourself. Now, I think that's fabulous. Maybe you don't like it. Like Red Skelton, I think the wrong bus came in tonight. You pray, and then you do it yourself. You've heard many times in this fellowship, if you pray for potatoes, reach for the hole. You know. If you pray for potatoes, reach for the hole. God helps those who help themselves. You know, it says that in the good book. God helps those who help themselves. Now, I think of this power greater than ourselves as the reserve tank. You know, in your gasoline tank. You got some reserve there on the side. But it never comes on to the reserve until you've run out of your other gasoline. I think of this power greater than ourselves as a reserve tank. When we have run out of our own resources, then what we lack is supply. But our first chore is to do it ourselves. This Catholic priest and the Jewish rabbi were sitting in a prize fight. And one of the boys that were fighting ducked down in his corner and crossed himself. And the rabbi says to the Catholic father, he says, what does that mean? And the priest says, don't mean a damn thing if you can't fight. You know? You pray and then you do it yourself, you see. Here are the steps we took. Now, it does not say, here are the steps we read. Here are the steps we heard read. Here are the steps we discussed in last night's discussion meeting. Don't say that. It don't say, here are the steps we interpreted. Don't say that. If you're still nipping a little and want to keep on, just interpret the steps. You can nip and interpret and interpret and nip and nip and interpret, and then you nip and don't interpret. Don't say here are the steps we interpreted. Neither does it say here are the steps we conned God into taking for us. They don't say that. Here are the steps we conned God into taking for us. It says here are the steps we took. Now God has a tremendous place in this program of ours, and without him we would have no program and we would have no sobriety. But it is not to take these steps for me. This is my job. Here are the steps I took and take. T-double-O-K, took. This is my job. Now at the beginning of step number 12, it says, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. Why do we, with our keen alcoholic brains, think that we can have a spiritual awakening as the result of 11 steps that we ain't took? you know. Says having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. Well, this implies that we've taken 11 steps before we get to the 12. That we have applied these things to us. And yet we don't do it. We tell each other, oh, it's, you know, it's not particularly important how you take them and when. You take them as you feel like it, or you don't have to take them 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. Take 1 and 12. You know, we hear a lot about two-stepping in this society. There's no such thing as a two-stepper. There isn't any such thing as a two-stepper. There's a half of the first and a third of the 12th. And I don't even make 1. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol and ran to carry the message. That's not even one step. Not even one. It's a half and a third. How are you going to carry a message you ain't got? It says in the back of the book, it is obvious that we cannot transmit something that we do not have. See to it that your own house is in order. You see? Why can't we read these things? And do them. You know, kids, we're dealing with one of the most insidious and one of the most destructive things in life. Alcoholism is a terminal disease. It is a terminal disease. And it is progressive. And the only thing ahead of you and I, if we keep drinking, is permanent insanity or an alcoholic death. Just two things can happen to us. Permanent insanity or an alcoholic death. Serious deal. And yet we tell each other you don't have to take a written inventory. I heard a guy, we had one out at Redondo Beach. He'd get up at this podium and say, I've been sober 5 years. I've never taken a written inventory. I never read that book clear through. Don't let him tell you got to do this or that or the other thing. You don't. I'm sober. He got up to 6 and he got up to 7, but he didn't make 8. He's drunk right now. Here are the steps we took. Now, there's a very definite reason for taking these steps. Because the key to sobriety, the key to this new way of life, is the acceptance of ourselves completely and totally as a defeat in the business of living, as a failure in the business of living. To accept defeat. To be able to abandon ourselves completely. Completely. Because, you see, we got to roll away the stone before we can get help from God. We got to roll away the stone. Something for us to do. And the first 9 steps of this program are there for the primary purpose of squeezing us out of ourselves. We're in a vice. And every one of those steps is just tightening that vice a little bit. And pretty soon the damned ego's gone. People say to me all the time, Chuck, how do you surrender? How do you surrender? The first 9 steps will surrender anybody that will apply them to himself. You can't do it and not become surrendered. You've got to. Let's look at them for just a second with this in mind. The first step is a twofold admission of defeat. I admit that I am an alcoholic, that my life is unmanageable. Well, now, this is not according to my former pattern. I have lived 43 years, and I never admitted that I couldn't run my own life, and I never admitted that I was powerless over 1 ounce of flit either. This is a total and complete turnabout in thinking and action. We admitted that we were powerless over alcohol. Imagine a drunk doing that. And that my life is unmanageable by me. This is just a direct reverse of the way I've lived for 43 years. Came to believe that power greater than self could destroy us society. A left-handed admission that we're as nutty as a fruitcake. We're nuts. Power greater than self, he gets in that step too. And I got to tell you this little one. I was listening to a colored boy, 35-ish, son of a gal that's been in our program for a long time. And he was talking a little, and he said, I think I always realized that there's power that kept the universe in order, kept the planets from bumping into each other and had the sun come up. Says, I think I've always recognized this. But he says, it never occurred to me there's bigger than I am. You see? That's us, you know. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. We're nuts. No use to restore a sane man to sanity. You see? So the squeeze plays on. We're in the vice. This is absolutely contrary to this keen alcoholic mind. Of mind. Third step, you got to get a new driver. Now, how many of you alkies ever voluntarily surrendered the wheel? Did you just go out to the parking lot and say, honey, you better take the keys, I'm drunk? Like hell you did. He says, get in if you're going. I'm driving, it's my car. If you don't want to ride with me, get a cab. But we don't give them $2 to get a cab with. We fight them all over the parking lot for 2 hours. Here we got to get a new driver, just in the third step. This is just three. A new driver. Made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God. Well, what's this doing to that thing called ego? What is this doing to a thinking and action process of, in my case, 43 years? It's destroying it. That's what it's doing. It's completely destroying it. Now, if you think the next one is an ego builder, get you a thick pad and a long pencil and start writing. Made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Now, this is a switch to a guy that's taking everybody's inventory that he ever saw, but his own, for years. Hell, I was an expert on your inventory. I could tell you what's wrong with you. I've crossed the room. I didn't have to get close. Well, this is different. We take a moral inventory, a thorough moral inventory of ourselves, you know. Made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Me! So we sit down with ourselves and we write down there on that thing our motivations for action.
What's been transpiring in my life? What have I been doing? What is my motivation? A thorough and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. This don't mean that I got to put down there every time I turned left when I should have turned right. It's the intent, it's the motive, it's the thing that makes us tick that we want to look at. You know? And the squeeze play is definitely on. And number five is worse than all four of them. Number five is a king-size ego killer. Because it says here that we admit it to God, to ourselves, and to another human being. To another person. The exact nature of our wrongs. Well, now I can write it down, and I've got it. I'm in possession of it. I can admit to God and to me. Hidden out behind the house. And nobody knows yet but me and God. It's still quite a secret. But when I lay this dirty linen out in front of another human being, boy, if you got any ego left after that, you ain't done it. Get honest. This is a killer. Nothing in me that I won't share. Nothing to hold back. Lay that muck right out on the table and go over it with another human being. A man or a woman that you feel you can talk with in confidence. A priest or a preacher or somebody. I like it with another alcoholic. Because I'm funny that way. We admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another individual the exact nature of our wrongs. And then we became willing to give this muck away. We've done a bad job. We've done a bad job. We can't get rid of these things on our own. If we could have, we would have. So we become entirely ready to give them away, to have God remove all these defects of character. And we humbly ask him to remove our shortcomings. We become willing to give them away, and we give them away. Now, I'm a simple guy. I do not believe it's necessary for us to pull these defects of character back out of the trash bin for years and years and years and beat our brains out with them. I don't read my book like that. My book says I became willing to give them away, and I gave them away. And I'm simple enough. People say, how'd you know if I haven't got them? If I've still got them, I didn't give them away. I'm simple. I still retain them, or I take them back. So you give them away till you don't take them back. We're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Humbly ask him to remove our shortcomings. There's not much ego here. And what is left is destroyed in the next two. These next two steps are the most fabulous things on the face of the earth. This is like an inside shower. We made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. And we made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. Oh, don't sell these short. These are the greatest. What a feeling it is when we have become willing to and do face these people that we have harm and tell them that we've harmed them And we're not only here to apologize, but to tell them we'll make restitution as soon as possible. You know, I had a picnic with this sometime back. It's been several years ago now. I got a call on a Friday night from a guy in Whittier. And he says, "Chuck, I'm sitting here with my revolver in my lap, just ready to blow my brains out. But Jim told me not to shoot until I talk to you." He says, "What he got to say?" I says, "You called me on a bad time. I says, this Friday, I'm talking tonight, I'm talking tomorrow night, and I'm talking Sunday night. I've got Monday night open. Now," I says, "you can shoot yourself on Tuesday just as well as you can tonight. So if you want to talk to me, come down Monday night and we'll talk. If you don't, go ahead and blow your brains out." So he came down on Monday night. And we were sitting there talking. And amongst other things, he was a gambler. And he lost large amounts of money that he didn't have. And we got down here to this man's step. And I said to the guy, "You know, we got to be able to go to these guys and say, look, I'm not the big shot that I would have had you believe. I'm an alcoholic. I've done you wrong. And I'm here to make amends." "Why," says Chuck, "I can't do that." He says, "Quite a few of these people are professional gamblers," and says, "they're tough." "Why," says, "they'll kill me." I said to the guy, "You reckon they will?" "Why," says, "sure." "Well," I says, that's good. You won't have suicide on your mind then. Let them do it." The guy started laughing, and he's still laughing. He's still laughing. He's paid off all his debts, and he's living like a king. You know? Oh, don't sell these short. This is like an inside shop. You get rid of all that stuff, and you're a free man. Now, that's 9 steps, and what have we done? We've rolled away the stone. We've cleared away the wreckage of the past. We've washed a few windows. And now we can look deep within ourselves with Brother Lawrence. Look deep within ourselves and find ourselves, which includes our relationship with each other and with God. Remember, Brother Lawrence said, if you would find God, look deeper than yourself, because it's the only place you're ever going to find him. It's the only place you're ever going to find him. Well, we can't look deeper than ourselves till we've cleaned the mess up. We got to get rid of the overburden. And then we can look deeper than ourselves and find ourselves, which includes our relationship to each other and to God. And this is the great discovery. This is the great discovery. This is what life's all about. This is the thing that religion calls being born again. Being born out of conscious separation, out of aloneness that Tommy talked so much about last night, into unity. Into unity. Conscious separation, conscious unity. Conscious separation, the problem. Conscious unity, the answer. And so we're born again. And now we can pray, seek through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious awareness of the living presence of the Almighty. We can do this now. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with our very own God. God as I understand him, God as you understand him. Praying only for knowledge of his will for us.
and the power to carry that out. Oh, thank God for this. This is the way I live. This is the only way I can live. This is the only way I can live. I can't run my life. I can't run yours. I can't run my business. I can't run my wife. I can't run anything. And I know it. I had 43 years to do that. And I ended up in the bottom of the snake pit. I can't do it, but I can pray for knowledge of His will for me and if I get out. And I get it. I live with the total expectancy of guidance and direction in everything that I do. You know, I am probably the worst mess that you will ever look at when I know what I'm doing. I can't even get to the right meeting when I know exactly where I'm going. I can't make it. I've told some of you here this weekend. I was going to a meeting in Pasadena about a year ago, I guess. And I know exactly where I was going. I have my names in the little squares on the Girl Scout calendar, you know, and I knew where I was going. I was going to Roy Seeker in Pasadena. I could see it written in the square. Hell, I could see it just as plain. And I went to Pasadena. I got there in time to get a sandwich and a cup of coffee, which I did. Went to the meeting, and the place was dark. And I said to myself, this is something wrong here. You know? So I get out my little book, and I look, and there are seeker meetings on Tuesday night. This is Monday. Villa Street's Monday night, but I'm not going to Villa Street. I'm going to Roy Seeker. So I say to myself, you damn fool, you put it in the wrong square. Now, mind you, I'm within a mile of Villa Street, and I'm 65 miles from home. But do I go to Villa Street? No. I wasn't going to Villa Street. I was going to Roy Seeker. So I went home. Well, Mrs. C was talking someplace that night, so I unlocked the door and walked in. The phone was ringing. I went over and answered, and the man says, where in the hell are you? I says, I'm on the other end of this phone. You gave me a bastard. Well, he says, you're not supposed to be. He says, there's 300 of us sitting up here at Villa Street waiting for you to talk. Now, there is the way I run my life. It's quite a convenient thing for me to be able to pray for knowledge of His will for me and the power to carry it out. I'll tell you that. And having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these things, and we can't do them and miss it. We can think we miss it because we might think that a spiritual awakening is something different. Something different. Something ethereal, something mysterious that might light on us or miss us. No. No, if we do these things, we will have a spiritual awakening. Tommy says, last night you feel peculiar, you know. And you wake up and find out you're healthy. You know? You've never been healthy before. We feel a little peculiar too because life is good. Life is good. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to the alcoholic who still suffers and to practice these principles in all of our affairs.
We tried to carry this message to the alcoholic who's still suffering. We tried to give this thing away that has been given to us. And in the doing, again, we prove something. Now, we never find out unless we do. Because, you see, action is a magic word. The only way on earth to convert intellectual knowledge into wisdom is through action. Act as though I am and I will be, saith the Lord. Action. So, we tried to carry this message to the alcoholic who still suffers. And in attempting to give this thing away, we discovered that this has never been a getting life. It never was. All the conditioning that I had in home, in church, and in school goes right out the window. Because I was conditioned to believe that I had to outthink, outperform, and outmaneuver in order to eke out a miserable living out of an unfriendly universe. And I beat my brains out doing that for 43 years. 21 years ago, I started trying to carry this message to the alcoholic who still suffers. I started trying to make amends to the woman and the kids that I'd crucified. I started trying to get even with the boss because he'd paid me for something I hadn't done. Trying to do something for God's kids that they needed to have done because I wanted to. And found that this has never been a getting life at all. It's always been a giving life. The more you pour out without a price tag on it, the more you have, because that's the way it is. It's not a reward for well-being, for good. It's not a all-day sucker for being a good boy. It's the way it is. This is the way it is. The more I pour out without a price tag on it, the more I have. How do I know? All I got to do is look in my own books. That's all I got to do. Infinitely more good has come into my life in 21 years than the entire previous 43. In every department of life. Every department of life. And I've never spent 5 seconds in 21 years trying to bring it about. Not 5 seconds. This is the way it is. It's a giving life. For it is in giving that we receive. It is in forgiving that we are forgiven. And it is in dying to self that we are born into the reality of life. The reality of God. The reality of unity. And we never know till we do it. And practice these principles in all of our affairs. And we are made whole. How fortunate can we be? How fortunate can we be? I am what I am this morning because of the accident of total failure. Total failure. I can take no credit even for coming here or even for living long enough to get here. There is no credit due me for anything because my determination, my choice, my decision was never to come here. And until I ran out of choice, I couldn't come. And I came here, what for? To find God? No. No. I'd been hunting for God for 30 years, and I'd given up. To get my wife back? No, she was gone, should be gone. And I wasn't entitled to have her back, and I knew it. To get back the love of my kids? No, 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 no. They were gone and should be gone, And I wasn't entitled to have him back. To get my job back? I knew that the boss meant what he said when he said, if you ever step foot in this plant again, I'm going to throw you through the window.
To find peace of mind and surrender to purpose, never heard of it.
I came here hoping against hope that I might find a way to live. That didn't include that alcohol. I would have settled for the meanest old unhappy sobriety on earth. Just so I don't have to drink anymore. Because I can't die with this kind of a record. I love that wife. And I love those kids. And they had nothing to remember but a tongue-chewing, babbling idiot drunk writhing in the floor. So I've got to have a little time to rub out what I've written on the blackboard of life. And I came to a bunch of drunks. The people I dislike most on earth. Because you see, I was a drunk and I hated me and I hated all of you. And I couldn't come to drunks for help. But there wasn't any place else to go. And people like you took me on their laps and rocked me to sleep. Strangers to me. But you see, I wasn't a stranger to them. Because I was a drunk. I was a drunk when I got here. They weren't. They were alcoholics. You see, we're drunks till we get here. And then we're alcoholics. You see? And they rocked me to sleep. And they said to me, if you want what we've got, do the things that we've done. Here are the steps we took. Just do these things one day at a time to the best of your ability. See what happens. Don't drink today, they said. Not that you've got to be sober 21 years. I'd have died if they'd told me that. But they didn't. They said, just don't drink today. Stay as close to us as you can, they said. Stay close to us. And they gave me a few names, and they said, now if you get hurt and too bad, call before you drink. Call before you drink. And let's see if we can't help each other. And I saw, and I heard, and I felt. And I decided I wanted what you had. And became willing to go to any length to get it. And I've been coming back ever since. I reckon I've attended maybe 4.5-5 meetings a week for 21 years. But since the day I discovered that I was sober, which was 6 months after I got here, I never came to one of these meetings in fear. I come to these meetings because I want to. I found life in these meetings. For the first 6 months that I lived in Alcoholics Anonymous, Alcoholics Anonymous was my home. See, I didn't have any home. And I come, and I'll continue to come, as long as there's breath in me. Now, isn't it marvelous that you come here willing to settle for just a way to live that don't include that flit, and find the whole package. And find the whole package. How fortunate can we be? How fortunate can we be? And those amongst us who think you might have lost some time, oh, I hear this so often. You didn't lose any time. You didn't lose an hour. I didn't lose a second. I didn't spend one second in hell that wasn't necessary. Because, you see, this is the only way I could have ever surrendered. I had to burn up. And in order to get help from this power greater than myself, I had to be able to recognize the need for this help. As long as I was going to do it myself, there was no help. There was no help. God was willing, but I wasn't. So I had to become willing. Now, out of this way of life have come these things. I haven't had to have a drink or pill for almost 21 years. In January the 10th, if I live that long and don't drink, I'll get a cake with 21 candles on. Now that's not bad. That's not bad. Because physical sobriety and life are synonymous with me. I can't have one without the other. It's the greatest gift God could give me, that I might live today without having to drink. So that's good. 21 years of it. Maybe 7,700 days that I would not have had, but for the grace of God through the miracle of AA. That's not bad. What else? I got a new body out of it. Took me 3.5 years to get over falling on my face after my last drunk. And I haven't fallen on my face for 16.5 years now. And that ain't bad. Got a new body out there. What else? My family was put back together. Miss C and I have completed 41 years. If we're still around in June 24th, we'll have 42 years in double harness. And that ain't bad. The boys, we're getting along pretty good. And that ain't bad. What else? I own the business they threw me out of. Now that's impossible. That's impossible. This is something I never even dreamed of whilst drunk. But there it is. And that ain't bad. But what else? Something that is infinitely greater than all of those things. I have a God of my very own. My very own. And I just woke up to the fact that there he was. The guy I've been hunting for forever. There he was. And wherever I am, he is. And I have a lot of fun with him. I'm not afraid of him. And I don't think he's afraid of me. And I share everything in life with him. Everything in life I share with him. The good and the bad and the indifferent. Just like a knot-headed kid. Something bad I do, you know, and I do them. I take that in the closet with me. And I say, look, Dad, look what I did yesterday. Isn't this awful? Isn't this a hell of a thing for a guy like me to do? But I did it, and I know why. And I don't like it, and you don't like it. And I'm going to do better. And with your help, I'll do a lot better. Sure, thank you. And I throw it away. I never care it another second. And a good thing happens like something like this morning. And I take the hat in the closet and I say, look, Dad, isn't this terrific? Isn't this wonderful? It couldn't happen to a bum like me, but it did. And I know where it came from. And I sure thank you. Because, you see, it's not normal to walk alone. It's not normal to walk alone. I walked alone for 43 years. It's cold outside. It's normal for us to walk down the high road of life with our arms around each other, sharing our experience, strength, and hope one with another in love. This is normal. This is normal. It's not normal to be away from the Father's house. It's normal to become as little children, totally dependent on this great thing called God. It's normal, just as normal as breathing. Because, you see, without God, there would be no breathing. Without God, no life. Without God, no intelligence. Without God, no peace. Because, you see, truly, truly, those first two words of the little prayer that we're about to recite together mean what they say. Our Father.